they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found. Ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. I'm Raf. Blah, blah, blah. In the middle of the screen is James. If you're listening to this on a podcast, that makes no sense to you.
How's it going today, Raf?
All right, all right, all right.
Technical
as Matthew
as
McConaughey once said, all right, all right, all right. Hey, dude, it's a Friday. We get to have a little fun today.
I know. It's Friday and it's nice out. Like that, two things. Well, it's nice here. I don't want to guess it. Might not be nice everywhere, but it's nice here.
My buddy, it is. It's going to be 78 degrees here. Beautifully sunny and quite gorgeous. I think we might have a stray cloud every once in a while here and there or anywhere. But overall, it's going to be awesome. So, no complaints. No complaints from me. On that note, let's introduce our guest today. He is Wesley Bellman. He wrote an interesting piece. Wesley, I'm going to give you a second to introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Wesley Bellman. I started in security in 2017. In 2018, I joined, at the time it was Air Force Space Command, which later became the United States Space Force. And I was asked to take over the products responsible for incident response, specifically like DFIR for the Space Force, which is where I first learned about SOAR, which we'll talk about today. So after doing that for a couple of years, I got the opportunity to go to the United States Southern Command and actually run the entire cybersecurity program for a unit over 1,000 people, which included security operations as well as compliance and communication security. Then I left the military mid last year, and joined the National Guard, the California Air National Guard, which I do part-time, and then full-time I work for Palo Alto Networks. Was pretty much the main person driving SOAR within the Space Force, the U.S. Space Force, and so that's kind of my claim to fame. And then our product there, which was focused on incident response, was as well as a couple other task was called Kraken. So Kraken is my claim to fame, and a few other people who worked on that with me. And that's our baby, which is still holding strong, I hear, now that I'm gone. So I'm excited to see where that goes on that side. So I know you wanted me to talk a little bit about the article I wrote. So it's kind of funny. I wrote, it's a bit of a clickbaity title, right? SOAR is boring. And one thing that's interesting about it is that I think a lot of people just read the title and immediately judge what what I'm saying, and they're like, "Oh, he must mean that SOAR is useless if he doesn't like it." But that's actually not my argument at all. In fact, I'm arguing that something that makes it useful and makes it a great product to buy is that it is boring. It's relatively simple. It's very common. It addresses common needs across different enterprises, with different missions, different business sets. So really excited to talk about that article and what my points are in there, and then also how, if people can move past some of the flashy words like automation, etc., that they can understand how to get actual value from SOAR.
It's kind of interesting to think, in security in general, what, 90% of it is boring? Right. I mean,
right.
It's still essential. It's still needed. But, the report writing, the analysis, a lot of that stuff is boring. But that doesn't necessarily mean like you're against it or anything like that. I think it applies to a lot of stuff.
Absolutely. And when Anton Chubakin first shared my post, I got a comment from actually another guy from Palo. I don't know exactly how to pronounce his name. I think it's like Jorg, like J-O-O with two dots on the top, R-G. And he said that. He said, well, you know, you could say this about a lot of things. That was his critique of the article. And I said, well, that's fair, actually. And actually having worked on some custom software as well in the Space Force, I can tell you it's pretty easy for people to underestimate the challenge put into software and say, oh, like that's just a couple of APIs and some other things. And people don't realize how much work is actually put into developing software, and that it's not just as simple as the interface or the APIs that the software actually utilizes.
Yeah. Listen, before we dive too far into this, I really want to know, because I'm a huge fan of, what's that?
Into the rabbit hole. No, go ahead.
Fair point. But no, I watch the Steve Carell show. Is Space Force anything like that?
I did watch the first season. There were some things that definitely had me really laughing and saying, wow, that's on point. There's also some things if you've seen the show Silicon Valley. The Space Force, as the DoD overall tries to go more digital, there's a lot of jokes in Silicon Valley that are actually applicable as well. I remember there was one scene in Silicon Valley where they talk about that there's this guy developing some like music searching algorithm or something at the very beginning, and they say he's making it like customer facing. And they're like, oh, like typical, like, you know, amateur developer just making it customer facing. And they were saying, could you imagine if we made it business facing and enterprised it? And I just like that had me rolling on the floor laughing. I could just imagine a general in our field, right, the IT field, saying, just replace business with mission. That's always the thing you do in the military. Could you imagine if we made it mission facing and enterprised it? And it was, I don't know, for me, it was just so on point. It was really funny. Maybe most people didn't find it as funny as I did. But I just found it really funny because I've definitely heard generals say stuff like that. And it's not that it's, you know, a bad thing to say. It's just really funny how on point it was.
Nice. Nice. Okay. Well, all right, let's dive in, because I'm not a, how do I word my history with SOAR? I think I'm just going to say it's complicated, the great cop out. But here's the deal: I initially thought the field, the SOAR field, was like largely. I don't know how I'm going to word this without pissing everybody off. It's Friday, and I don't care. Why did we ever, if products did what they were supposed to do, why the hell did we need the folks to develop something called SOAR to actually make the things work together, right? If all these best of breed, you know, to use that crappy buzzword, all these delightful, well put together API products work so well, the hell did you need, you know, a bunch of scripts that would make them all work together, right? And then having worked with it, for a while, there are some things that I learned that, there's good reason to have this around. And then I'm sort of back to diverging from that, because SOAR has simply become, like, it started as, and I'll shut up after this because this is a long diatribe, but it started as an orchestration and automation between multiple tools across our space. All right, so across our SOC. So that when the SIM finds something, it can tell something else to go do something and then pull data and refine and like all these things. What does it actually do now? Like, what do we do now that you can't do without a fancy name on top of it? And more importantly, is the space anything really more than trying to make security tools actually work? Am I too cynical?
No. So I guess I can talk about sort of why in the Space Force we developed the SOAR requirement. And really our first requirement was operator focused. So it's focused on an analyst, someone who's actually doing day-to-day work. And the focus was on their experience. Their focus was not on, okay, how do we use this to stitch these different products together And then, like you said, kind of have the SOAR tool run automation to have them communicate back and forth with one another. And that can be used in some cases, but I agree with you. If that can be done without that SOAR tool, that's going to be better. It's generally going to be faster and simpler. I've had several cases in which people present a SOAR use case, and I ask, well, is this something that, like, is this a sign of just a failure of our ability to implement our enforcement points, whether that's on the endpoint or on the network, right? And I think if it is, then that's something that you should try to move to those specific devices. So I definitely agree with you. I can say kind of a couple examples. So one example would be, there's a lot of people focused on this whole like closed loop. You know, you get some sort of an alert from one of your sensors, whether it's like an endpoint or a network sensor, and then your SOAR kind of goes all the way through and closes the loop and does some kind of incident response, whether that's to make a new rule in your network device, whether that's to isolate an endpoint, something like that. And the question is, the question becomes, if you have such a workflow that all happens automatically, is one of your enforcement points, like, why is your network security not blocking that type of activity already, right? If it's something that you're so confident in, you don't need any DFIR analyst to go in and investigate, that you can just automatically close that loop. And I think that occurs as a band-aid, so to speak. It can be something where you might put that in place because you don't have the expertise, or you don't know exactly how the tool works in order to create that policy. But I do think that's something that, if you have a lot of those things running, that's probably something you should get rid of. I saw one SOAR vendor posted on LinkedIn. They were really proud. They were processing 1 million incidents a second or something absurd like that. And I wrote a comment on there in LinkedIn. I said, well, this seems like a failure in alerting, right? If you're alerting 1 million incidents, like, if you're so proud that you alerted 1 million incidents a second, you can process that. Like, that's some, you know, unrealistic number. Why is your alert generation mechanism so crazy that you feel that you need to build all these playbooks to just constantly, constantly close those out or respond to them or whatever? So really, that's, to use kind of the NIST cybersecurity framework terminology, that's, I guess, trying to move more things from detect to protect, which is a continuous process. But I still think SOAR becomes valuable to kind of defend it against one sort of your concerns would be, it becomes valuable from the perspective of the actual user. And from the user's perspective, it's really nice when you can interact with tools. If you need to interact with a tool directly when you're performing an investigation, it's really nice when you can interact with that tool from the same place where your case management occurs. Right, and all major SOAR vendors, that's how that works, and that was a really strong requirement for us in the Space Force. We had several vendors that met that requirement, and that was really helpful. And then when it comes to automation, what was helpful was, if there is a certain type of event that you need to process, and there's a query that you need to run very frequently, so that you can see that data right in front of you as you begin that investigation, that's the type of automation that we were concerned with. Not actually automating incident response in the sense of some sort of isolation or something like that, but actually just making a query to bring all the data into a place where the analyst could see it and then begin their investigation. If there's a certain query that they would run at the same time, like every time that there was a certain type of incident.
So you're using it. No, go ahead, James.
I was just going to. So is SOAR a methodology, or is SOAR a tool? Because I mean, initially I'm thinking it's a methodology, but at the beginning of what Raph was saying, like, I'm like, that's what devs have been doing forever. Like, they automate their tasks. They, you know, have AMP builds. They have all this stuff to go through it, right? So identifying, okay, this person does that. This analyst does this daily task. We're going to figure out how to automate that. Like, I don't know if we need a title for that. But then if we look at it from a tool perspective, does the tool come with those preset automations that most analysts across any SOC, you could say they're doing this? If I get this SOAR tool, like, I don't even have to think about how do I automate that. Like, that's already identifying those places that we need to do that automation.
So I heard a couple of questions. So one question is it a tool or a methodology? I've always treated SOAR as a tool. Automation can definitely be considered a methodology. The second question I heard was, what was your second question? It was, yeah, you asked too many questions.
James had a one very at a time, complicated man. Series yeah, of questions.
I know. It's a whole thought thing that's going on here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, basically just trying to think about it. Like, do the tools do that automatically? Because I'm thinking, like,
oh,
what
right.
I heard was,
so the
you know, is that you've got,
gotcha.
Yeah, like you've got a SOC analyst, and, you know, you said you started with, all right, what does this person do? What's their day-to-day? Like, this
right.
is the problem we're solving. So do the SOAR tools kind of come with that pre-box? Like, if I went and got a SOAR tool, it kind of answers those? Or do I still have to, as an organization, look at my analyst and say, what are you doing day-to-day? And then try to align it with the SOAR, like, modify the SOAR tool. Like, how much modification, I guess, is there when you get a tool to be able to do my day-to-day versus your day-to-day?
Gotcha. Right. So that was the second question, the pre-built playbook. So, right. So every SOAR tool that we looked at, did come with pre-built playbooks, and we always use those as inspiration. Now that I've worked with other customers, those have been good inspiration, but no, I wouldn't say, that you could just, you know, plug and play the existing playbooks, across different SOARs and just use them today. That would be, that's something I've mentioned several times actually, is that, those are there for inspiration. We usually you can fork those playbooks pretty easily, but no, they're not. It's not just this. Yeah, plug and play, hit your button, and then you know now your security is automated. Hooray! That's certainly how it's sold very often. That's certainly what you know. If you read marketing on SOAR vendor websites, you'll see that. But no, it's not.
Well, that's
like
how
that.
Every tool is
sold. Right. But it's
right. I mean, everything you get out there, they'll tell you. You just plug it in, it works. It's got you.
Right. But I definitely,
well, everything
if you're
going to
be
implementing
a SOAR tool, I definitely recommend you have a, you know, they call it like a content developer, someone who is going to be able to adjust playbooks. And honestly, someone who has a little bit of coding experience as well. A lot of them use like Python or JavaScript. So if you have someone who has experience and can adjust automations or even build custom automations with those, that's going to make your SOAR journey a lot more effective.
It's still up to like the individual organization to really do their own self-analysis of what do I want to accomplish with SOAR?
Right.
Like what jobs do I want to automate out? And then can I do that, with the product I'm looking for? But that's not coming in ahead of time. Like you can't just be like, oh, I'm going to go SOAR today.
Right. And I would say if you're not comfortable, if you're an organization, you're not comfortable doing that, then probably MDRs, like managed detection response, is something to look at. As compared to having your own in-house SOC.
All right, my turn.
Go ahead.
I've been thinking about this quite a bit. So as you guys are talking, what makes this different, or why is this different than when I think Anton would call this SIM 3.0 or something, when SIM was supposed to be doing data analysis and contextualization and all that stuff for us, right? You talk about various queries being run, data being gathered for analysis, right? From set place A, feed B, store C, log D, all this stuff, bring it together, show it to me so I can go, okay, now this makes sense. Now, why is that different than what we were sold as what SIM was going to do for us?
Okay, that's a good question. I think I would say that the difference comes as soon as the analyst begins their investigation, right? So if it's just, you know, if you're just presenting data to the analyst, sure. Like I totally agree with you. SIM was sold and probably should be able to do that function. However, as soon as the analyst is presented with that data, they are going to have several tasks that they are going to perform based on their expertise and based on their expertise, right? And this is something I've talked about a lot. Is I have one article, I can't remember exactly which article it was, but I do have one article So a lot of people, when they're assessing their SOC, they do the confusion matrix thing, right? Like, how many true positives do I have? How many false positives, true negatives, and false negatives, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the when people measure that, a lot of times it's focused on what is my alerting mechanism, what is my SIM? And I like to say, let's like consider the whole system, right? A lot of people focus on machine learning for this too, right? But don't just consider machine learning. Don't just consider your SIM or whatever your detection mechanisms are. Consider your people as well, right? So all the way to the point where you have identified something as an incident, test those people as well. And the people are going to close out false positives. They're going to pass things to higher tiers potentially, and determine if those are also effective, right? And so that's why I always say that so SOAR is really about user experience, in the sense that you are trying to make it so that the user's confusion matrix, or what they add to that confusion matrix altogether, is as effective as possible. And so what does that mean? Like, that's, I know that's very high level and vague. So let me try to explain that in a little bit more detail. What that means is,
steal that for me.
Right. So what that means is, there's, like I said, there's automated things that you can do where you can perform an investigation. But not all those things are going to be predictable, right? There's not always going to be enough information from the alert in order to perform the next steps of the investigation. And when that happens, we still have SOC analysts, right? SOC analysts have not gone away. Maybe when they go away, this won't be a discussion anymore. But as long as we still have SOC analysts, we still have organizations in which it's required for a human brain, a person who's a human, to go in and to add additional context and solve additional problems beyond what's just available within the data and in the alert, or what's automatable at this time, right? And so that means that they have to go in and manually execute various tasks, which is kind of funny now that we're having this discussion, but I'm almost saying that what makes SOAR special is the manual tasks, right? It's sold as an automated tool.
This is where
The manual tasks, though, are much more focused.
Right. They're more focused and more streamlined, right? Like, because you have connections into all of your different other tools, right? You have connections to your threat intelligence. You have connections into all of your other different tools. And when you run a manual task, that manual task can also be you can run it manually. You can say, hey, I need to run this type of query. However, a playbook can already be built for that query. So if it's multiple steps, so for example, if you need to run process breadcrumbs, right? So for those who aren't familiar with process breadcrumbs, you determine, you find a process, and you find what the next process that process spawned and what spawned that process, and you can go forwards or backwards within that, right? You need to take a process ID and you need to pass that into the parent process ID. If you were to do that in a SIM, and that would be multiple steps. You would copy paste, right? But if you wanted to run process breadcrumbs and do find 5 or 10 spawn processes out of a parent process, that could be a playbook where that process ID is passed into the new one, and then that would be a query that's run. However, you might need an analyst whose experience has told them, I want to see, like, what are the next 10 processes that this process spawned, and then they get value from that information as they're conducting their investigation.
Okay. All right. So that's hugely valuable, and I can see how that works. The follow-up to your comment about the value of SOAR being the people and the individuals, how do you then create some... Ask this a different way. Has SOAR become a vehicle and a repository, essentially a GitHub internal for scripting that individual users can kind of create for the way they behave? Is it tailored to the person, or is it tailored to the way a team works, or is it tailored to the organization, is what I'm asking? What level is the utility, the main utility at, right? What's the highest level of utility I have? So, if I'm buying a SOAR system, is it going to be... Should I be told that, hey, this thing's going to be tailored around the way this organization functions as a company, or the way this sock functions as a unit, or the way this tier of sock functions, or the way this person functions? Which is those?
Right.
You can't say all of it.
Right. Can't say all of it. It's not allowed. It's not allowed. So I've seen situations in which kind of one person runs the, you know, runs the sore and other people use it, and then it becomes it does become kind of inaccessible to others, right? And that's a that's not ideal. So that's definitely something where, you know, people need to work together to understand the content that's within your SOAR platform. Ideally, if I was in that SOC, I would like to say it's representative of how that SOC functions, how that, like, that SOC's team, what they consider their workflows and their day-to-day to look like, to go back to James' point from before. Ideally, what does end up happening, right, is that individuals kind of build things or understand certain pieces more than others, and it does become disjointed. But that's not the ideal. If the SOC can learn to work together as a team, then it can become more of that sort of SOC-wide functionality. And then that also helps with your whole bus factor, right, that everybody talks about, where if you lose that one person who understood all this content and these different playbooks and how to run them, and you were just passing those tickets to them, then if everybody really understands the different content, then it's reusable. And that is another thing that we were looking at as well in when in the Space Force was the bus factor concern. If someone, if you have certain people who are very skilled on certain products, security products that are used in a customer environment, then we did find that with SOAR tools, people were able to do some very basic, run very basic playbooks, interacting with those products without having to learn all the ins and outs of those products, at least for kind of an entry-level analyst.
Let me take this a slightly different direction.
Gotcha.
Because I think I have a clear understanding of what we're dealing with now. This spawns a different question in my mind, and it's one that I've had debates with colleagues about, and I'll just pose it openly. Does this, or is this part of the evolution of the SOC analyst? And what I mean by that is tier one, tier two, tier three still a thing? Should it be?
Gotcha. So this is a common debate, right? Is will tier one exist? At least the way that I've heard the debate is, will tier one exist, you know, in a year? Maybe
for like 5 years in a row now.
Yeah, exactly, for 5 years in a row now. I know. So to add some additional sort of history, in the DoD, so before the Space Force started looking into SOAR, there's an organization called the 33rd Network Warfare Squadron, which runs all the business systems for the Air and Space Forces that are, like, you know, personal machines and some basic websites and stuff that we use internally. And they run the SOC for that. And they were the first ones to look at SOAR, and that's where I first actually learned about it. And when they kind of sold it to me, it was very, yeah, we're going to get rid of tier one SOC analysts.
Never happened, huh?
Hasn't happened yet. We'll see. I don't know if I can predict the future on that one. I mean, there's still always going to be, like, if you're an entry-level SOC analyst, you're an entry-level SOC analyst. Like, you can't just suddenly have experience you don't have, right? Being said, I do have an article I recommend people read called Analysts Are Killing the SOC. It's my second most popular article after SOAR is Boring. And I actually criticize, it's mostly a direct criticism of the DoD and how there's this whole, like, cyber operator mentality, and there's a desire not to put people on the actual security engineering or even security operations engineering. And so we just basically, our focus is just generate more alerts, more analysts, right? That's the solution. I know that was a solution in the industry not that long ago as well. I think most commercial customers I've seen no longer feel that way. But
I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why. Yeah, but the I honestly, like, my assessment, my personal assessment of the Air Force in particular, is there's very much this, you know, more alerts, more analysts, you know, call analyst operators, call our SOCs weapon systems, say that they're operating this weapon system. And then it's actually true. So there's the Air Force has, you can look it up. This is,
yeah, okay. You had some ahead. Of that, but I mean,
go ahead. No,
I mean, yes, some of that exists. And I know it. I mean, I know it does. I've got friends that do it as well, but like to completely change try to change the dynamic by simply calling things different stuff,
right?
Different names. I think it becomes a little disingenuous, you know, things it's calling orange, you know, a different color just for the sake of calling it a different color.
Right.
Doesn't accomplish anything. Right.
Absolutely. No, I meant to agree with your eye roll. I definitely agree with it. Like I agree with the criticism that, you know, if you call, once you start calling it a weapon system, there becomes this mentality shift that, you know, all of our, you know, that everyone who's a security analyst needs to be a pilot. Right. And that becomes that mentality that, you know, to only operate is, that's the only thing that's of value. Right. And it's not true.
Yeah.
So I agree with your eye roll. I know that there were some other reasons that they decided to call those weapon systems. But if you read, there's a public article by General Skinner, and he makes the argument for why he feels that these cyber tools need to be called weapon systems. And I don't really agree with him. I think that has caused harm. I know he had good reasons for doing that, but I do think it's caused harm. And I write about that in that article as well.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, it's like, change the name, you change the perceived value. And I mean, I'm not anything in the government, but you classify something as weapon system, that changes the value of that system, that changes the need, that changes the protection. It's no different than we call everybody a freaking researcher, even though they're not, right?
Oh, no, James went there.
I know, yeah. Listen, you don't want to tick people off. I'm okay doing it. You know, but you look at, like, we want to write legislation and use the term researcher. Like, it changes the value of what you have. Whether it changes what you do doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it changes the perceived value of that. So being in a different organization, like, security's done this for how long? I mean, we were ninjas for a while. We were named the stupid name that we came up
still
with.
Are.
you know, like, all this different stuff, we came up with these crazy names. Look at all the internal testing teams that have these crazy names. Like, we're security, we're something special. That's not changed, I don't think, at all. I think what's interesting, though, like, I don't know about the debate of, you know, do we get rid of tier one, tier two? It definitely sounds like the more we automate that, the less of those we need, right? So instead of more numbers, less numbers, I need one tier one to be able to handle everything now. But how does that affect, like, when you hear the constant talent shortage and people can't get in?
I was just about to ask that,
and it's
James.
Like, that's great. All the entry level jobs, there's one now for, you know, all 5
yeah,
million
you,
of
you.
Yeah,
you've broken the assembly line for, right. for the higher order talent. Good job.
Like, yeah, the barrier to entry now is level 3.
Right.
And it's like, well, wait a minute, I can't get to level 3. There's no 1 and 2. Like, it's an interesting dynamic that gets created there. But I see the use of, listen, make it more efficient. Should I be sitting there looking at a bunch of stuff where I'm just like, no. Like, you know, I mean, you're not doing anything. Whereas, you know what, if I'm going to push a button, there's purpose to that button this time.
Right.
You know, because that's actually going to make that difference. Yeah, it's interesting.
I don't know. All right, before we run out of time here, Wes, where does the, you know, you're obviously intimately involved in the space now. Where does this go? And where is the head of, you know, people that are product managing these things, doing product strategy in this space, where is their head? Because I've had a couple of conversations with probably folks you may know over at the organization that you're at. And a couple of that, because I know some friends at competitors in the source space. And every time I have the same conversation, I walk out of the room going, huh? Because it's basically, we're going to fully automate the SOC, and we're going to get rid of all these manual processes. And on the other side of it is, we're going to better glue together all these tools that don't work together still. and make that work better. And all I'm saying is, if we kill the assembly line or the progression chain for somebody that to be a better analyst, that's not good, right? We're already in a shortage situation. This isn't helping. It's sort of like it accomplishes short-term goals by breaking the long-term arc. But there's got to be some accountability for better security, like for security tools actually working together. I mean, 25 years, I am still waiting for tools that work together. we laughed. I was at a back when I worked for Optiv. I went to a McAfee QBR, and they introduced what was that? What was the name of it? They had an acronym that was going to tie all their security tools together with like threat intel and stuff. What was the name for it? Anybody remember? No? Anyway, it's like the WAF and the firewall and the endpoint agent and the IDS. They were all going to use the same, they're going to all talk to each other. When one detects it, it's going to block it on all the other ones. And it was like, oh my God, you're solving the problem. 5 years later, they're like, yeah, so we couldn't quite align release cycles. So this product has this feature, but this one can't use it yet. And by the time this one gets here, this one will be maybe retired or like over here. And bottom line is it didn't work. At what point do we make security tools work together in a way that makes the SOC actually efficient? And I don't mean processing alerts faster, because right, that's not the human's job, right?
Right.
Like if you're sitting there going, I need to buy a SOAR tool. If you're spending $1 million on a SOAR tool because you need to clear alerts faster, I think you're doing it wrong. Maybe that's just me.
Right.
But I feel like we need to clearly set goals for what we're trying to do with each piece of software we bring into the SOC. Otherwise, you end up with tools mania, right? And we're not actually solving problems. We're, in fact, creating new ones with what we perceive as a short-term, like, cool factor creates way bigger problems on the long tail. And that's where I want to end is where's your head at? Where is this space going?
Gotcha. Lots to unpack there, right? One piece, I guess.
It's a lot to unpack.
It is a lot to unpack. One thing that you said that I think relates back to my article is, kind of trying not to let the cool factor get to you too much. And I think SOAR, like some people, it might be worth recognizing for some people that SOAR, SOAR's value is somewhat going to be in maintenance, right? And what do I mean by that? So if you read the article, you can see I kind of make an argument for why you shouldn't build your own SOAR at the very end. And we had people, we had sort of several people in the space force or contractors who really wanted us to go out and build our own. And one of my biggest concerns with that as the PM was that we would have to maintain all these different APIs, right? Like, did we really, like, how much would it cost to hire developers to just constantly update these APIs? Like, if you work with an EDR tool, those guys are updating their APIs very frequently. Every time they add a new feature, there's a new API associated with it. But when you centralize that, right, if you work with a SOAR vendor, they have several different customers who are paying them money so that they can hire developers and they can update those APIs for everybody. You think, right. And it's not perfect. Right. But in my opinion, it is better than doing it in house, because developers are expensive
all day long.
Yes. Developers are expensive. I think some things like that, some things like the ability to scale. If you have in the government, most people are probably aware, we have large like storage requirements. So you need to be able to scale your storage of your case data for a long time. That kind of stuff is, you might be like, this needs to be more automated, more ML, more, blah, blah, blah. Where are we going next? And I think it's worth kind of me adding, and I hope this doesn't, you don't feel like I'm shooting you down, but I feel like it's me adding that, there's almost value in just maintaining the sword tools kind of as they are, but just keeping up with the requirements to interact with other tools as those tools change, and to be able to store more data or do more processing as that's required as well. So kind of nothing fancy, but just be able to continue to meet the requirements they're already meeting as the security world changes.
That's a fair answer.
So to your question about when will everything work together? Let me answer the question about the skill shortage, because that was actually in my analyst or Killing the SOC article. I do talk about that, and I made sure I wanted to address that because I knew that was going to be a concern if people are saying, well, like if you can't, if you don't have entry level analysts, then how do you even get into this field? And from a military perspective, the military actually is pretty good at bringing people in who have no experience. That's one thing that the military does a little bit better than private sector. They'll bring people in with no experience, train them, give them opportunities to grow. And so my recommendation for the military was to train people in security automations engineering, data engineering, et cetera, from the beginning. And that might not be a popular opinion yet. But in my article, I attended a SOC engineer webinar with, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Nate O'Reilly and Ken Underhill. But I know Ken Underhill's pretty.
I know the name. I know Ken's name.
Yeah, they're both pretty active on on LinkedIn. And they talked about SOC engineer. It was funny. The title was SOC engineer. And they only mentioned like one thing about a SOC engineer. And the only thing that they said about a SOC engineer, and I mentioned this in an article, is that as you become an analyst, you can go up different paths, and eventually you could become a SOC engineer if you want to go up that path. And that's the only thing they said. That might sound like a dig on them. I don't mean it as a dig on them. The audience was asking questions actively during the webinar, and almost all of it was just, how do I even get into this field? How can I become a tier one SOC analyst? So it's not a dig on them, but the title of the webinar was not at all about what they actually talked about during that webinar. But that one thing that they did say, maybe that's true. I don't know. My opinion is that should not continue to be true. So as we're trying to find different pathways for people into the security field, I think one thing that we're going to see is more people might skip the analyst role altogether, and they can go straight into SOC engineering. They can go into data engineering, etc. So you maybe disagree with that. Again, that might not be a popular opinion, but that is something that I've argued. And another thing I've argued is that you could actually bring those people in from other fields, one being another data field. So if there's another field in which people are exploiting data, they don't have the domain knowledge, obviously, of being a SOC analyst, but they do understand how to gather insights from data, whether that's medical. I have friends who work as who do very similar roles. They're running queries in not SIMS, but in data lakes, right? And they're running queries, and they understand how to structure complex queries.
Well, it's a transferable skill set.
Exactly. So I think,
all right, I got to cut us off there, because we're going to run way long.
Gotcha,
but
gotcha.
This is a Wes, I'm going to have you, I'm going to bring you back, because I'm going to go grab Anton. I'm going to get you. We're going to find, I know at least one other person I got to get in this round table, because I want to talk about, we're sort of wandering in and out of this topic, but
gotcha.
What a modern SOC looks like, right?
Right?
What the skill sets are, what the roles are, what its job is, how it's tiered. Like, how do you set up a modern SOC? And all right, that's for next time. Thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
We have had, we've streamed a LinkedIn Live a couple of times pretty successfully, and I thought we were through the bugs, but good golly, they're having problems this morning. Their API is buggy as hell right now. I tried to jump in, and because people are like, hey, you're not getting it. We're not getting your video feed. And I'm like, I know. I got an error. And I posted a reply, and it's an error. Try again later. I was like, what? Hit enter again. Error. Try again later. Hit enter. It posted.
LinkedIn Live 4 is not working as it should. That's what happens. Their automation's broken.
What's that?
Their SOAR is not working.
You know, I appreciate the LinkedIn Live capability, being able to stream out to people that follow you, or that we have the show page and all that. Which, by the way, folks, I really, really encourage you guys to go check out, if you're listening. Check out our LinkedIn page. LinkedIn will eventually fix their API and we'll be streaming consistently. But also bookmark our YouTube page, which is if you go to the MP3, ID3 tags on the MP3 that you're listening to probably, there's a link in there under the website tag, has the actual playlist on my YouTube page. But the video is going to get posted. I'll put it into the I'll edit and compose this video, and I'll put it on the DTSR LinkedIn page. Thanks for listening, James. Thanks for getting up on Friday morning and doing this with me. It was fun.
Yeah, always a good time.
And this is a great topic. Wes, thank you so much again, and we will have you back. Folks, thank you for listening. And this has been another lovely Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast, and we will catch you another time, another place, on another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao, everybody.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.